Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 13th of January. We have so many things to discuss today. Yesterday, President Bush gave his last press conference and said that there is no such thing as short-term history. Don't think you can possibly get the full breadth of an administration until time has passed. Is that true? Can we judge his presidency now? A lot of confirmation hearings going on. Today, of course, Hillary Rodham Clinton hearing is taking place, and we'll talk about that. The one that is facing perhaps a little bit of controversy is Eric Holder as Attorney General, and we'll look at a little bit at his background. We also have other hearings that have already taken place. Tom Daschle for Health and Human Services, head of that agency. We will talk about how smoothly that one went. Our guest says that Congress should not be timid about passing legislation to empower the legislative branch. She has written recently about the executive power. We'll look at executive orders. President-elect Obama expected to close Guantanamo Bay. And what do you think about this overall idea from Evan Bayh, and others have said this, that the overall confirmation process, it's not automatic, he said, but the chief executive deserves the benefit of the doubt unless there is an ethical lapse or incompetence. All of these topics and more on the table. And our guest is a wonderful analyst. Professor Julian Zelizar is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of many books examining U.S. political leaders, policies, and institutions since the New Deal. His books include Rightward Bound, Making America Conservative in the 1970s, On Capitol Hill, The Struggle to Reform Congress and Its Consequences. He's working on four other books, A History of National Security Politics Since World War II, A History of the Jimmy Carter Presidency, The Reagan Revolution, and an edited volume about the George W. Bush presidency. Well, welcome phone calls, as we always do. Our number here is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Professor Julian Zelizar, a pleasure to have you with us again. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. President Bush said yesterday there is no such thing as a short-term history. Don't think you can possibly get the full breadth of an administration until time has passed. Do you think that's true?
Well, he's right and he's wrong. I mean, the evaluations of presidential legacies change over time. We never think about a presidency the same way. 10, 15, 20 years from now, things might look very different, and he's right about that. And there's certain areas of policy, including foreign policy, where we have to see outcomes over the long term and not just the short term. But he's wrong in that, you know, on many immediate measures, he has not accomplished what he set out to do. On many domestic policies, he doesn't have the record he hoped to have on an issue like Social Security, where there has not been any reform. And by immediate measures on foreign policy, it's hard to judge Iraq or Afghanistan as a major success.
Did you see a more honest, more apologetic President Bush yesterday at the press conference?
On certain issues, I mean, I think on the war on terrorism, he remains firm and convinced that he did do the right thing and that overall his policies have helped secure the United States. And he wasn't very apologetic. And I think we'll, you know, continue to hear that tone after he leaves the White House. That's been rather consistent. On Katrina, he wasn't very apologetic either. I mean, he sounded not even very defensive, just saying that criticism about what the administration did was misguided. On weapons of mass destruction and the failure to find them, that was the one area we heard a little more of an apology and kind of a sense of what went wrong, as well as with mission accomplished.
Right. And he also said that Abu Ghraib was a huge disappointment.
A disappointment, right. And he does speak badly in the press conference about the kinds of activities that took place. Again, though, he coupled that with an overall defense of what the country did. It's kind of a consistent view we heard since that scandal broke, meaning these were a group of bad apples who did this rather than it being a result of the policies pursued.
Mm-hmm. What about this question of, tell me what you think this means, whether or not he lost it, and what it is the new president could do to restore, if you believe we've lost it, America's standing in the world?
Well, you know, I think that's been one of the biggest criticisms of the administration, that we started with this moment after 9/11 where there was enormous goodwill for the United States and a willingness to work in alliances with the United States. And gradually, the Bush administration ruined that, that first they consciously avoided working through alliances to deal with the war on terrorism. When we handled Iraq, it was done in a way that was openly dismissive of the idea that we needed to kind of listen to what other countries were saying. He was very explicit on that. And as a result of the policies, including the interrogation scandals, you know, the image of the United States suffered since 2003, since 2004, and we've never recouped what happened early in 9/11. And I think, you know, I do think he's aware of that. It's hard to miss it if you're in certain parts of the world, although he's popular in certain other areas. And I think, you know, the Obama administration has consciously started his presidency, even back this summer while he was running, with the promise of trying to recover America's standing abroad. And I do think, you know, that is a failure, certainly, of how Bush handled the war on terrorism that will need to be repaired very soon.
Mm-hmm. And has Obama, do you think, done some of that simply because of who he is?
Yeah, I mean, his narrative is a story that is international by definition. He comes from many places in the world, and I think that has been something very attractive to people following this campaign, that he isn't kind of a person who defines himself only through his time in the United States, but like, you know, immigrants in earlier part of American history, he sees his connections all over the world, like many of us do at this point. And I think that's been very attractive, not just in terms of his own story, but in terms of seeing the possibility of a president who will not run unilateral foreign policies. And so his story is quite important to the policies he's going to try to pursue through the State Department in particular.
It is. Every time I hear him speak, every time I think about his life, I like the way you put this, his narrative is international. It's extraordinary how international it is, how different it is, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think as the campaign unfolded, people were literally learning about his history, because it wasn't a self-evident story.
Right.
And he's really, you know, he himself has traveled around the world, not just, you know, where his family comes from. And so, you know, it's not just even the post-Bush moment. It's kind of, it's almost fitting that we have a president who has roots all over the place in this moment in world history, when the connections, you know, between different countries are very strong and the lines separating us are disappearing.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about executive orders. You've written some about this, and it's a broader topic, but you talk about whether or not Obama will use such orders as frequently himself. I'm wondering about the Guantanamo situation. I understand that he may close that facility next week. Is that via executive order, and can you talk more broadly about how President Bush used this and how it is that Obama might use this or not use it?
Well, the Guantanamo is the first thing he's announced. It's a closing that I don't think, it sounds like it won't actually happen for a while. It might take over a year or more to close down. But symbolically, that was, you know, very important, because Guantanamo became a symbol to critics of the war on terrorism about how the methods used to pursue terrorists had undermined some of what we hope to achieve by weakening civil liberties and our treatment of detainees. But then there's a broader question. I mean, I think Guantanamo is just really symbolic at this point, to be honest. Does President Obama use the same kind of heavy-handed executive strategy that we saw from the Bush administration? What is he going to do with national surveillance programs that, under Bush, circumvented the legislative process? You know, will he use executive orders to achieve policy goals, maybe in the environment, that seem difficult to achieve through the legislative process? And, you know, will he basically continue with some of the interrogation techniques that have been used or allow them, even when closing Guantanamo, which doesn't eliminate kind of the broader set of policies? And we don't know at this point. I mean, Obama was very critical of Bush on this front, but thus far he actually reversed himself on one key decision, more important than Guantanamo, was when he said basically he'd allow the surveillance program to continue, and he supported the congressional decision to authorize it. which many supporters were unhappy about. So now we really have to watch, and Congress has to watch, is there a break, or, which is equally likely, does he continue, maybe to a lesser extent, but does still continue an executive-centered kind of approach to public policy?
Mm-hmm. Let's look at some of the hearings that are taking place today for Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. One press report said that this is going to look more like a tribute than an examination of a controversial politician. Do you think she is controversial, and will it look more like a tribute to her today?
Well, I think it's going to look more like a tribute to her. I mean, Democrats are not in a fighting mood, and of all the Democrats who are up, or all the people who are up for confirmation, Republicans, you know, tend to like her. I mean, she's pretty popular on both sides of the aisle. She represents a kind of approach to foreign policy that that Republicans are enthused about or comfortable with. That's a better way to put it. And so Kerry will take her on a little bit, I assume. There'll be the stuff about her husband and the trust. But overall, I think she'll be received pretty well. I mean, this isn't the confirmation that's going to cause some explosions. That's going to be Eric Holder.
Right.
I think, you know, she's a pretty safe choice. And I think Obama, you know, despite all the talk about the tensions between them, they're not that far apart on foreign policy. Iraq was a dividing line. But on other issues, from multilateralism to diplomacy to kind of supporting a rather hawkish Democratic position on areas like Afghanistan, this is a pretty logical choice beyond the politics of it. And I think she'll be greeted well today.
Mm-hmm. Every time I look at her, I think, I don't know if you do as well, hard worker. She's going to be a hard worker.
Absolutely. I mean, and that is something that is consistent from everyone who knows her,
mm-hmm.
everyone who likes her and hates her.
Mm-hmm.
She is a very kind of hard worker. She does not give up, which causes a lot of frustration. And I think she'll set out to do this job very well. I mean, I think that is one of the attractions of her in this position. This is a State Department that is in disrepair in many ways. It's been ignored for 8 years. And the State Department arguably is going to be the most important component in a new foreign policy agenda, because if a new agenda revolves around multilateralism and negotiation with other countries rather than a more Pentagon-based military approach, she's the point woman now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they want someone who's going to try hard, who won't give up. That's kind of what she did in the primaries is actually what you want in negotiations overseas. Someone who'll just stick with it,
right,
even after initial losses.
Right. Eric Holder, is the problem with the pardon of Mark Rich, or is the problem with Chiquita Bananas, or what?
Both. I mean, the Chiquita Bananas, I don't know kind of how much play that will get, his support of kind of corporate conglomerate clients and what he was doing. That's a problem almost, you know, all people in Washington can face easily if they're lawyers or lobbyists, because they all deal with a million groups. And I don't know, I think kind of American skepticism about everyone is so high that in some ways, ironically, they're willing to let something like that go. And it's harder to understand exactly the story and connections. I think the Mark Rich is a more politically difficult issue, because it's a kind of clear story, one that many Americans who follow politics remember, about the pardon of a not so great person who was a campaign contributor, whose wife was a campaign contributor, and a appearance of some kind of deal by Bill Clinton, and that's easier to bring back. And what, you know, did Holder do in that situation? I think that could actually be a problem, because there's, again, you're looking in Senate hearings for very clear stories, kind of with bad guys and good guys, almost comic book stories, and that is one.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think he's going to need to really explain what he did, what he didn't do, and in some ways justify why he signed off on that pardon. I don't think he can just ignore it. It's out there already. But that, you know, Arlen Specter, leading Republican, has voiced some concerns. And this gets into the issue of executive power, so it makes the Democrats a bit defensive. The pardon is the ultimate power of the president, besides war. And here's a case where it seems to many that the President Clinton abused that power, and here's a guy who supported that.
Right. In this case, is it something that he did that was egregiously wrong, or do you think that the Senate will say, well, the president is just starting, he's got the new administration, it's a whole new America, we need to give him the benefit of the doubt here, it was his choice?
Yeah, I think it will go. I mean, I think it could be a few ugly questions, and he can kind of get beat up a bit. But overall, my guess is this will still be confirmed. And in terms of the public, I think, you know, when you have an economy that is this in this bad a shape, and you have international turmoil, as we see in the Middle East, I don't think America has the stomach for much in terms of confirmation fights, unless there's something really big and really dramatic. And I think, you know, Americans might tune in, they might get angry, and the Holder and the Obama people handle this well, my guess is it could kind of go away, and people are ready to look at other things. This is just not issue number one or priority number one when people are looking for a job.
Right. Let's welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about saying goodbye to the old administration and the president's press conference yesterday and all the hearings that are taking place this week and looking to the inauguration and a new administration starting next Tuesday. Our guest is Professor Julian Zelizer. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of a number of books and contributor to many national television and radio programs and press publications as well. We do want to tell you that we are carrying National Public Radio, that is, a special one-hour wrap of the Senate hearings, and that will take place tonight, actually. President-elect Obama has picked Clinton to be Secretary of State, and the special report is tonight at 6 o'clock. Paul Brown from NPR will be talking about highlights of Clinton's appearance before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Special coverage from NPR News at 6 o'clock tonight here on the Ideas Network. To your calls in just a moment, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program this Tuesday, Adam Cohn will be joining us. He's an editor of the New York Times, and he's the author of Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America. Let's go to phone calls now for Professor Zelizer, and we start with Chris from Blue Mounds. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, hi. I noticed the president's press conference and his body language and nonverbals were just really defensive, which suggested to me he is really worried. I think he's probably worried about the reputation of the entire Bush family legacy and how it may be cast by history as a polar opposite to, say, the Kennedy or Roosevelt administrations. And I'm also curious about just what this means for political and economic methods that were so influenced by people like Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld, who actually were in power for a short time under Gerald Ford. So that would be my question and my comment.
All right, Chris. Thank you.
Well, on the first question by Chris, I do think he's defensive. I don't think, there's two images of Bush. One is he's not very intelligent and doesn't think about these things. The other is he thinks about these all the time, and he's kind of almost quasi-manipulative. I do think he's a president, though, that thinks about his legacy. He's talked about this a lot. People who surround him are very aware of kind of how does he fit in the larger history of conservatism, of American presidential politics, and he can't miss the criticism that's out there. You know, even if he doesn't have a BlackBerry or even if he's not reading all the papers, it's hard to ignore, especially at a press conference like this. And, you know, I think what we've seen in the past month or 2 months, A, he's dealing with the economy, but B, he's trying to be defensive, to try to explain, to try to actually shape how people think of him before he leaves office. This is his final time where kind of the world is listening. And so from doing the Protection of Oceans executive order that he did, I can't remember how he actually did that, but the other day he has a measure to environmental measure to these kind of statements in press conferences where he's really justifying the war on terrorism and trying to remind Americans, hey, you know, we've been safe since 9/11. I think he's trying to counteract all this criticism that's coming of him. I mean, at this point, he's almost a combination of Jimmy Carter and Richard Nixon to many Americans, kind of inept leadership combined with, you know, unethical practices through the executive branch. And I don't think that's who he wants to end up being when all of us write our textbooks. And so this is a president who's trying to define his history as he ends his term in office. The second question, I wasn't quite sure. He said economics and politics of people like Rumsfeld and Cheney, who've been around. They were in the Nixon administration. They were very high up in the Ford administration. And both of them have been fighting certain wars, not literally, figuratively, since the 1970s. One of the most important was this embrace of executive power. Cheney has been a strong and adamant defender of the idea that the executive branch is more efficient and more useful and should be trusted more than Congress. And he came of age in the 1970s, and he's defined his vice presidency around that issue. And I do think there is interest and pressure for a reversal of some of the trends we've seen. But as we said earlier, it's a lot easier to talk about curtailing presidential power than to do it when you control the White House. And there's many reasons to think that in the end, the Obama White House will keep much of the power that, ironically, President Bush has given the institution.
Hmm. You mentioned BlackBerry. Let me ask you about, because I think this is important for a president. I remember doing an interview, some interviews with some of the Nixon administration people years and years ago, and they talked about, you know, getting in the White House and having the limousines meet you and becoming so terribly out of touch with regular American people. Ehrlichman said that, and he was struck by that. And it seems to me as though one of the reasons people like Obama, or many people do, is that he has some kind of connection with the South Side of Chicago, with, you know, going to the deli to get himself a sandwich. He likes the BlackBerry so he can be in touch with what a wide range of people are thinking. Do you think it's important for a president to have that kind of, I think it is, the contact with ordinary Americans, and how in the world can he do it?
Yeah, I mean, it's important for any president to have as much of a sense of what's going on in the nation outside of what his or her advisors are saying, in terms of gauging where mm-hmm. is the public on certain issues. And it's essentially impossible for a president to do. And, you know, the fact is, even if Obama has his BlackBerry, he's not going to have time to be writing, you know, a friend in Illinois very much about what's going on in the local supermarket. He's now president of the United States, and he's facing three or four crises a day and trying to juggle all of these things. So part of it is you're literally in a bubble in the White House, or, you know, traveling on Air Force One. Second is just that you lose time to have a real life anymore. And so naturally you lose a connection to what's going on in the country. And presidents, you know, do suffer from this. I think you can argue gradually Lyndon Johnson during the 1960s lost a sense of just how unpopular the war was becoming, or kind of Richard Nixon became so isolated and so insulated that he lost sight of the kinds of things he was doing to maintain his power, which in retrospect just looked so horrible and almost difficult to understand how someone could think some of his activities to intimidate opponents were legitimate. So that's what happened. You know, there's always a picture of presidents when they leave the White House. They're much grayer than when they started.
Yes.
And there's always some kind of tragic picture of them sitting alone, you know, with their head on the table or something, or sitting alone in their seat. And the isolation of the presidency is something that's that will happen to Obama as well. I don't know how you kind of resolve that. I think it's just part of the institution.
Mm-hmm. John is calling this morning from Mexico. Hey, John. Are you there, John?
Yeah, I'm here, but I'm kind of listening on the internet, and so I've got some background noise.
Okay, we hear you
anyway,
fine.
Two points I want to... Hey, how are you all?
we're fine, John. Go right ahead.
Here.
We hear you fine.
Good. Two points that press conference yesterday was theater of lunacy, it seemed to me, and two things came out of it. One thing came out of it Theater of Lunacy yesterday.
Just keep talking, John.
Okay. The two things that came out of it was, one, that Bush admitted that he was involved in the waterboarding decision of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that came out of it was, it seemed to me that the administration really was always backward thinking, in the sense that they were always coming up with a solution and looking for a problem or a pretext that where they could apply the solution. And I want to know what your guests or you, Kathleen, thought of that.
All right. John, thank you. Hope you're well, and thank you so much for calling in. John was a longtime resident of Wisconsin. Professor Zelizer.
Well, I didn't hear the waterboarding part of the press conference, but, you know, it fits with, you know, the other kind of message on how he handled the war on terrorism. Look, it's just an area of dispute, and I'm not sure how you resolve it. I think to his critics, that call is right on target, that, you know, here was executive branch that had certain things it wanted to do, and the justifications came later. So that can start with the war in Iraq, and you can also talk about new methods of interrogation and national security surveillance that became justifiable in their minds because of the war on terrorism. To defenders, that's not the story, including Bush himself. And I think part of what he wanted to convey in that press conference is, look, I'm not just, you know, some kind of tyrant seeking to aggrandize the power of the White House. I was trying to protect the country after 9/11, and this is how it has to be done. This is the only way, he was saying, that I could get the information that saved millions of lives, even though you don't actually know what you know I was trying to do. And that's an open debate, and it will be a debate that we continue for the next 100 years. And part of what we'll have to look at is, as the records come out or made public, what records do become public, is to try to understand and evaluate kind of what methods accomplished what, and what were the internal debates about the value of interrogation to getting information about, you know, someone who wants to blow up a city. And I don't know, but I think the caller captured the argument perfectly.
Thanks, John. Let's go to Earl next from Medford. Hi, Earl.
Hi, good morning. I wish I was with John in Mexico.
Cold up here. I know. Wouldn't it be great to go somewhere warm today? I love Wisconsin, but oh my gosh. Yeah.
Professor, I've been trying to absorb all the Bush attempts to set the record straight and things, and I don't get any idea of a concern for the human suffering that has resulted. Economically, the deregulation of the finance industry and things, people are losing their pensions, they're losing their savings, and I don't sense him feeling or taking any responsibility for that. And abroad, Iraq, you say historians might view it different down the road or something, but it was a major, major mistake. And people are dying, people are being displaced, we're spending huge amounts of money, there's so much suffering at a war that maybe didn't even have to happen. So how he can expect history to change the perspectives on some of these things, they seem like slam dunks, to use one administration term.
Well, I mean, that's a fair point. I would say that we've seen historians see events radically different than they were seen at the time. So one of the comparisons that Bush himself likes to make is Harry Truman. And it is true that when Harry Truman ends his presidency in 1952, he is enormously unpopular. And the arguments being made about how Korea was just a total debacle and debacle, and that his overall foreign policies were basically undermining America's standing in the Soviet Union were very strong. I mean, it cost Democrats the White House and Congress, and he is a very unpopular president. Now, if you read about Truman, it's a very different picture. We look at the National Security Act, or the Truman Doctrine, or the Marshall Plan, and he's often written about as one of the heroes of the Cold War, the person who kind of planted the seeds for the national security state that was victorious against the Soviet Union, and that we didn't see it at the time. So there are ways, and that's just one example, where presidents can be transformed, even when at the time, you know, it seems like a slam dunk, quote unquote, that they will never be recouped historically. There's very few presidents that don't have some defenders over time. Herbert Hoover, I guess, is one, or Buchanan. But most presidents have some kind of recovery. Even Richard Nixon now, historians have been writing about non-Watergate things. They've been writing about kind of the changes in foreign policy in terms of achieving detente with the Soviet Union. They're writing about how he was a Republican who allowed for kind of very bold environmental measures that might have been impossible with a Democrat, or had ideas about welfare reform that later became very cutting edge, not just with Democrats, but I mean, with Republicans, but liberals. So that's why I'm always hesitant to say anything's a slam dunk in terms of how historians are going to look at a presidency. And we should be aware of the kinds of changes we see. And it could be many changes. People could look well back at Bush in 20 years from now, and in 30 years say, actually, it was a disaster.
Thank you very much, Earl, for the call. We're going to be talking about FDR the next hour of our program, and I'm struck by some of the parallels. Certainly the country is in as rough a shape as it was in 33, but somebody wrote this, and I wonder what you think about it. If Obama is able to instill confidence in the American people and the national government and in himself and in his inaugural address, which I'm sure will be terrific. He's a heck of a speaker. And if he is able to get underway to announce a series of initiatives that appear to be both bold and with the promise of being effective, those are the two things that would be most like FDR.
That's absolutely true. I mean, I don't think the objective has to be immediate economic recovery. That might be impossible at this point. If you're looking at FDR as the model, yes, the first thing he did was to instill confidence through his speeches and through his action. Confidence not just that the economy will eventually be okay, but confidence that there was competence in the White House and that you had a leader who would fix this one way or another whenever the recovery might be. The experimentation part of FDR is equally important. It's not just about instilling confidence. It's about the reality that fixing this economy, both in the short term but the long term, is going to be hard. The answers are not clear in terms of what we even have to do, as they were in the Depression. It's not like there is a group of economists sitting in the White House who say, well, once we achieve A, B, and C, you know, it will be the 1990s again, or whatever period you want to use as a better period than today. I think the reality is we are in an unknown period. And so what FDR did under those conditions, he tried one program after another. You know, he tried rural electrification for rural areas. He tried dealing with the production of business and unionizing labor. He just tried a lot of different things to see what worked, and some were failures. Mm-hmm. The National Recovery Act, which is part of the first 100 days, is a total failure. And that was okay in some ways, because other parts of the first 100 days, like the banking reforms that protect people's deposits, were a success. So I think Obama could look back to FDR for both the idea of instilling confidence, but the idea of being bold, not just in doing a lot, but doing a lot of things, some of which you know might not work, until you find the right mix of policies that will create stability again. Remember, the 1930s ends, and we're still kind of in pretty bad economic shape. In the end, it took World War II spending to get us out of the Depression. So FDR did a lot of things in terms of stabilizing the economy, in terms of repairing certain holes in the economy, but it wasn't a very smooth path, and it might not be for Barack Obama either.
You say it's not clear what we have to do. You, as a professor of history, must have some ideas about what it is we need to do to fix the economy.
Well, look, there's obviously certain structural problems that have been talked about before Wall Street ever collapsed. So kind of the cost of health care is one of these basic issues that businesses, not just citizens, have been worried about. They've continued to escalate. They're straining you know, the cost of some of these automobile manufacturers that now need a bailout. There's many Americans who are losing work time because of health care problems and their own out-of-pocket costs. They're not going to buy a TV. Instead, they're trying to catch up on a bill for a doctor. And it's clear that if you dealt with the health care issue, and I don't know what the solution is, there's many plans out there, but dealing with that as one problem is going to be key to overall economic recovery. That's just inevitable. Second, you know, curbing some of the practices we've seen on Wall Street through new kinds of regulation seems essential. I don't think you have to be from the far left to accept that. Part of this economic collapse came because of wrongdoing on Wall Street. People who took advantage of good times and took advantage of the fact no one was looking and lost a lot of money in the process. And that leads to dramatic swings in the market, which are not only costly to people, but they undermine confidence for the future. And when you have some kind of regulatory system in place, you can create a little more stability in terms of the swings of the market. And I think they need to do that. And then, you know, jobs right now, you know, there's a lot of businesses that are not doing well. So part of it is to try to stimulate and spur on new areas of economic growth. Whether you're talking about public jobs for the time being on infrastructure repair or maybe creating green jobs, as they're called, all the experts are saying that's going to be one of the biggest areas of job growth, green jobs, in the next two decades. That could become kind of the computer industry from the 1990s. You know, rebuilding buildings to creating new energy sources. And why shouldn't the government now take the lead in getting that started? Maybe at first through public works combined with money for investment in new green technologies. That seems like a great economic program that could really get things going again.
And the Earth will thank us for it.
Right. I mean, I don't even mention the environmental argument, and I think in some ways right now Obama won't either. It has to be seen. This is actually something that the economy could benefit from right now. And I think in some ways that's a powerful argument just for getting it going, but obviously, yes, the environmental effects are ultimately what you're looking for.
More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Julian Zelizar. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, is the author of a number of books, including Rightward Bound, Making America Conservative in the 1970s, On Capitol Hill, The Struggle to Reform Congress and Its Consequences. He's working on a number of books now, A History of National Security Politics Since World War II, A History of the Jimmy Carter Presidency, The Reagan Revolution, and an edited volume about the George W. Bush Presidency. Our phone number, one line is open if you'd like to grab it, 800-486-8655. And our email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a reminder, tonight at 6 o'clock, join National Public Radio for highlights of Senator Hillary Clinton's appearance before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Special coverage from NPR News tonight at 6 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. And we do want to remind you, as you are making plans, you political junkies, for the inauguration, that NPR is also covering the full day of inauguration starting at 9 o'clock in the morning next Tuesday. Back to phone calls for Professor Zelizar, and let's go to William from Colfax. Hi, William.
Hi. I'm thankful that it's almost over, the George Bush time. It's been such a long time that sometimes I think they're claiming, the Bush administration claims all this, you know, how safe he's kept us and all this sort of stuff. But I remember in the beginning when Richard Clark was trying to warned the new administration about the threat of Al-Qaeda and their plans on attacking the United States, and he couldn't even get a meeting with Condoleezza Rice. They were too busy trying to privatize Social Security and figure out new ways to enrich their friends. And then, so I think that the whole thing might have been avoided, and then he takes so much pride in that. And I think that in a recent interview, and I can't remember who it was that interviewed, and they said, the woman asked him about that there wasn't Al-Qaeda, wasn't in Iraq, and his response, but they are now, and his response was, so what? I mean, and I thought that was really one of the most revealing comments I've ever heard from him, other thing that I think that they should be remembered for is how, and I think these are impeachable offenses, how he's gutted the Constitution, really virtually eliminating the Fourth Amendment.
Professor Zelizer.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, on the protecting the homeland, in some ways that's one of the core arguments that the administration will continue to make. There's two parts of the record. One is saying, well, it's been safe since 9/11, but you had 9/11, and you know it's like the Great Depression economically. So it's like, once you have that failure, that nothing you do can really be an accomplishment. Everything's basically a response, and that was the worst disaster. So that is part of the record. To be fair, Richard Clark is still critical of the Clinton administration, and part of his argument has been really not just a failure of Bush, but an overall failure of both parties, of the whole national security system, to deal with the threat that emerged in the 1990s and not to take it seriously. And then the second part is what happened since 9/11, and I do think that you will continue to hear kind of revisionist arguments, not just from Bush supporters, but the argument that, look, after that disaster, we did have some significant reorganizations of our intelligence, of our Homeland Security program, of our airport security, and we have to at least kind of grapple and think about the idea that we've been safe from attack, not just because there haven't been attempts, which there have been, but the fact that they've generally been averted. And so I think you'll see a lot of historical debate over kind of what that says about the success or failure of the programs. The other two parts, I think, are kind of less likely to be revised very soon, meaning you're not going to find a lot of supporters who say, well, Bush's decision to go into Iraq was actually key to the war on terrorism, that was a good decision, that really made the nation safer. And the last part, actually, I'll take it back. It will be controversial. It's this issue of methods, and it's the big issue. It's the, 24 television show question. Kind of, what are the costs of using techniques like waterboarding, and what are the benefits? And I certainly can't comment on that at this time, but I do think there's many Americans who feel that we have undermined civil liberties and kind of international practices of how to handle detainees so much, and the benefit has not been so great, that is really kind of one of the worst moments for what the administration has done.
Thank you, William, for your call. Judy from Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I thank you for this show. I really I finally understood the fireside chats. This weekend on Sunday, although I had to watch it on my laptop, George Stephanopoulos interviewed President-elect Obama, and he was calm and peaceful. He spoke in large, complex groups of paragraphs. When Stephanopoulos would try to interrupt him, he would say, no, let me finish this thought. And at the end of the interview, I felt peaceful and convinced that a competent president was going to take office. I was no longer as worried about the day-to-day turmoil in the news. I watched a bit of George Bush yesterday, and again, I was frightened. He is so disjointed, and he has so much difficulty with language. He has so few complete thoughts, and I am so looking forward to the Obama presidency for the contrast.
That does capture what many people felt about FDR, and in these fireside chats, he spoke on the radio. They were very calculated. I mean, FDR literally thought about how far he should be from the microphone, and made all kinds of small adjustments with the idea that he really wanted to convince Americans who were sitting and listening around the radio that they could be calm, knowing he was handling the situation and kind of soothing leading the nation was extremely important, and I do think Obama exhibits some of that quality, at least thus far. People respond well when they hear him. They have just a good feeling about the person who is handling this crisis. That said, it took a lot more for FDR to achieve confidence in the nation. It wasn't just the speeches. A lot of it was the legislation. A lot of it was actually doing things and getting things through Congress that helped rebuild the economy. You know, if FDR spoke to everyone that the banking system would be fine, he could have made a million speeches. But if he didn't actually protect the deposits, I don't think the calm would have continued. So I think now Obama has to couple his ability to speak well and to replicate some of what FDR did with the other part of FDR's legacy, working with Congress and really getting landmark legislation through that deals with the fundamentals, that deals with the foundations right now, because that's the only way we're going to not be where we are today 4 years from now.
And what is your initial assessment of how Obama is doing when it comes to dealing with congressional leaders in the Senate and in the House when it comes to his economic stimulus program? He's running into, you know, a little bit of controversy here. Are they going to pass any version of what he would like?
I think they will. I mean, he's actually getting some flack from the left. Some Senate Democrats were unhappy that one of the first things Obama has proposed is a tax cut. And that sounds a little too much like Bush, a little too much like Reagan, a little too much like Clinton for many Democrats. And they've been arguing that, you know, you really need to use the money for public spending. That gives you the biggest impact. That will have the best chance of getting the economy moving, whereas tax cuts usually don't work. They certainly don't work in the short term, and we've just had one tax cut fail after another in terms of stimulating the economy. But in general, I don't think that criticism is enough to kind of turn this into a legislative disaster. They're pretty much on board with some of the ideas coming out of the White House. All Democrats are determined to not get stuck in this economy, and I think that's more posturing, it's more negotiation. Thus far, Obama's been speaking a lot to Congress. He's met with them many times. He's very close to Pelosi and Reid. I think he's meeting with them today or tomorrow. He's even meeting with Republicans. So I think at least right now he's trying to court Congress rather than to run right over it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a smart way to do it.
Judy, thanks for your interesting call. Let's go to Gary from Chippewa Falls next. Hi, Gary.
Good morning. I guess my thought yesterday when I saw that it was a clip of the President Bush's speech when he talked about the presidency, it was like he alluded to the fact that it wasn't much of a challenge. And I guess, I mean, when I saw that, it was like, holy cow, you know, it's like you're talking about one of the most important jobs in the world. And I think that shows his inefficiency. It's like, you can do, I'm a golfer. I shoot in the 50s. Isn't that tough? Well, wait a second. I'm not a good golfer. And I think that's his problem. I mean, he just doesn't perceive things the way we do. That's scary.
I do think President Bush gives that demeanor off. It's always been a problem. And I don't know if it's true or not. I don't know what he really thinks, and I don't think anyone really has a good sense yet of how hard he works or how much he worries. But he certainly gives the demeanor, he's always done this, that he just doesn't take it very seriously or that he doesn't have a real sense of the job he's doing. And there's a casualness about him that just it doesn't come off well. And I think many Americans have felt that. And when you're in a period of crisis, it's even worse. So, you know, this dates back to the jokes about him going to the Crawford Ranch all the time and being, you know, one of the most well-vacationed presidents in American history through his demeanor at the press conference. And it's funny. I mean, I think other presidents can give off that casual approach, kind of, I can handle this, and it comes off, you know, well. It doesn't work with him. And part of it is as the problems of his presidency increase, we see that demeanor, and it looks even worse because Americans are now suffering, and he still doesn't seem, you know, overly concerned or over-worried about the work that he's doing. Mm. And so I think it captures, you know, it's like his father had a little bit of a problem conveying the sense he really had a feeling for what Americans were living through with the recession mm-hmm. in 91 and 92, and ironically, I think he has that same problem.
Thanks, Gary, for the call. John from Appleton, hi.
Yes, as a non-Bush supporter, I do remember distinctly giving Bush credit for actually getting the inspectors into Iraq. He said, my goodness, he's really put the fear of Allah into Saddam Hussein. And I remember then, of course, that when we came to invade and bomb, we had to tell the inspectors to leave. And so it was actually the tip me off is that the history professor that was on between 7 and 8 repeated what Bush said on an interview, I think, with ABC, that we had to invade Iraq because he wouldn't let the inspectors in. They were already in. I mean, is he really that deluded, or does he think the historians are not going to go back and look at the source materials in the newspapers?
I don't know. I mean, my instinct is this is a president who will forever be scrambling with the entrance into Iraq. It was one of the most humiliating moments, I'd say, in presidential history to go into war, not so much for the UN inspectors, but on the argument of weapons of mass destruction, and to find absolutely none. I mean, it's very hard to think of a comparable example in history. And so I think what you've heard since 2004 is a scramble for different arguments about why we did it, whether it's the UN inspectors not being in there when they were actually in there, to the democracy-building arguments, which weren't actually very strong when he started, and clearly not a central part of his agenda. My guess is he knows historians will look into this. I don't think it's the historians he's targeting. I think it's the public.
Thank you.
The public doesn't look so careful.
We have to go. You're a marvelous guest. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me.
Professor Julian Zelizar, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this excellent show, and thanks to Rob Schroeder for taking your excellent phone calls, and we'll be back following the news coming up next.